The Roman Empire, with its Colosseum, its gladiators, and its ancient cities, frozen in time. No other power dominated the planet for so long. But what are the secrets that helped Rome rule? It remains one of history's greatest riddles. Until now.
There are about 60 features that have appeared, which show up in these red circles.
By using satellites, one archaeologist will uncover a Rome that no one knew existed. Finding buried settlements, forgotten forts, and lost amphitheaters.
It has never been discovered before.
As far as I know, it is a completely new structure.
I'm Dan Snow, a broadcaster with a passion for history.
50,000 people would have packed into here.
This is my chance to join this revolution in archaeology.
Wow, that's wonderful. That looks like a Roman fort.
Together, we'll journey to the four corners of the Roman Empire.
Sarah, there's a fork in the road here. Do you want to go right or left?
We just continue on ahead according to my GPS.
From the mountains and the rivers of Europe.
Can you see it? I'm touching it now.
To the hot deserts of the Middle East.
It's a very special place for me because I came here with my mum and dad when I was a kid.
Across the vast interior of Africa.
What the satellites are showing us is just so much more left to find.
To the glory of Rome itself.
That is awesome.
And guided by the best Roman archaeologists in the world.
So how amazing is this view?
Tell the real story of how Rome ruled.
BBC, Rome's Hidden Secrets. In an American town, a motorcyclist rides across a junction, then the sign outside a used car garage.
Our journey begins not in the old world, but the new, in America's deep south.
Dan Snow, a man in his 30s with short, dark hair, is at the wheel driving along an American road beneath a cloudy sky.
I've always been absolutely fascinated by the Roman Empire. I think it's because when I was a kid, my mum and dad dragged me around the Roman sites like Hadrian's Wall, and that really fired my imagination. And then as I've grown older, I've studied the Roman army, tactics and the technology, fighting those battles, the legend of which has just echoed down across the centuries. There's always been one thing about Rome that's absolutely intrigued me.
At its height, the Roman Empire was vast. Pushing out from Rome, through modern-day Germany, France and Spain, up into drizzle-soaked northern England. Stretching eastwards, over the mountains of Middle Europe. All the way to the sun-baked deserts of Syria and Jordan. And south, across the immense, rich plains of the North African coast. This was an empire that covered 5 million square miles and had a population of at least 60 million people. That left Rome's army of around 300,000 troops, massively outnumbered, 200-1.
Yes. The Roman army was the best in the world. But at the same time, how could Rome rule over such a vast empire with such a small number of professional troops? It's a question that's always baffled me. And that's why I've come to Birmingham, Alabama in the United States to meet a woman who I think is going to help me find an answer.
Dr. Sarah Parkak is an associate professor of archaeology at Alabama State University.
There have been a number of cases throughout history where people have used identity.
By day, she's a regular college lecturer,
purely Crusader period. I mean, it had a big arrow through its chest.
But at night, it's a different story.
When I was a small girl, I always just imagined myself on a rocket ship. We're going to be finding other planets, and we're going to be meeting aliens. Here we are. We're in this lab. You know, it's like I'm in that spaceship.
Sarah is a pioneer in the new science of space archaeology.
The vehicle for exploration is a computer. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of archaeological sites and features all over the world that haven't been found yet. I know they're out there to be found. And if you hit the right button, it'll just pop up in front of you. That moment of discovery, that aha moment, that's like you're landing a ship on another planet. The doors are opening for the first time onto a completely new world.
Sarah's in her 30s with shoulder-length blonde hair, a satellite hovering above the Earth.
She's using satellites orbiting 500 miles above the Earth. They're equipped with high-resolution cameras developed by the military for spying. These satellites can pinpoint objects less than a meter in diameter on the Earth's surface.
Satellite cameras zooming in on terrain and sharpening the focus.
12 months ago, Sarah had huge success in Egypt.
For the whole of Upper Egypt, I have found over 1,200 ancient sites.
Uncovering long-lost temples, tombs, and even pyramids. Using satellites to change our understanding of Egyptian civilization forever.
All right, Dan, so I want to show you how this technology works. So we're going to go to an Egyptian settlement. And what you're really seeing is the equivalent of an aerial photograph, but taken from space. And what we do is we combine the high-resolution technology with infrared technology to get this.
Wow.
So really what you're seeing are the outlines of buildings, structures, and even ancient streets.
That's like a map of downtown Manhattan.
But, you know, I have to say, this is really the technology at its best.
This time, the task will be much harder. The Roman Empire was 6 times bigger than Egypt. And not simply desert, but a multitude of complex landscapes and terrains.
There's an area here in Romania, and we're very, very interested in this area. We know that something interesting might be here, but unfortunately, there's a problem.
There are a lot of trees.
There are many trees, and satellites simply cannot see through trees. It's impossible.
Okay, that is a challenge.
So this is something that we're working through right now.
Okay, well, this is the thing, Sarah. The bottom line is, are you going to come with me around the Roman Empire? And can you and your technology help solve this central riddle, how this empire was ruled? Because if you deliver, if this technology delivers, these could be some of the biggest breakthroughs in Roman history for hundreds of years.
You know, I am definitely up for this challenge, but this technology, it's not without its limitations. So on the one hand, I'm really, really excited about what we might possibly find, but on the other hand, I'm also pretty nervous.
The sun shines through tall, spindly trees lining a pathway. Wearing a Yale soccer t-shirt, Sarah's jogging along the track.
I guess there is that jeopardy of finding out whether or not I really am an expert at doing this.
The sun casts shadows over Sarah as she runs through the autumnal trees.
Running is where I can really clear my head and allow myself time to think.
Her feet pound the ground as the pathway becomes a road.
I am determined. I'm a pretty focused person. Once I set my mind to something, I'll just run into a brick wall until it falls over. That's not always wise because you end up getting quite bruised and bloodied. But eventually there are cracks that show up.
She packs a bag and heads down some stairs. Now, a map.
Our quest begins in the capital city of Italy. Rome. Where else?
They're crossing a street in the city.
At the height of the Roman Empire, roughly the first 2 centuries AD, this was the most extraordinary city on the planet. Crammed with glittering palaces, triumphal arches, and amphitheatres.
There you go.
That is awesome.
Colosseum.
It seems the obvious place to begin. Or is it?
They're on the prow of a motorboat speeding along a tree-lined river.
We're heading 20 miles west along the River Tiber. To a place now long forgotten.
Now they're in a rowing boat.
It's said to be the lost jewel, the glittering secret behind Rome's success, which could provide vital clues.
That is awesome.
As to how it ruled its vast empire. This is Portus, the once great harbour of Rome. For 500 years, the most important seaport in the entire world. At its heart was a gigantic hexagonal basin, still here today. Big enough to berth 150 ships. Which 2,000 years ago was attached to an even greater basin, 6 times as large. A series of canals have been identified which once linked the harbour to Rome.
A computer simulation demonstrates.
But there are huge gaps in our knowledge. And to know how this port complex actually worked might give us a better understanding of what made the empire as a whole tick. But it's a mind-boggling challenge. Over thousands of years, the sea has receded 3 miles to the west. And much of the harbour is now buried beneath a chaos of suburbs, flyovers and roads on the edge of Fiumicino Airport.
A small stone dwelling in grounds. Inside, Sarah's at a desk studying files.
While Sarah sets up her base of operations, I'm off to meet the world expert on Portus, the renowned British archaeologist, Professor Simon Kay. He's here leading a team, which, once the weather breaks, hopes to excavate the site. In the meantime, I'm grabbing a moment to learn more about the harbour.
Why did Rome need this great big port right next door to it?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I think you have to remember that Rome was an exceptional pre-industrial city, nearly 1 million people, and 1 million people living in an imperial capital. So you need food on an unparalleled scale in a pre-industrial society. You also need all the effects and materials that dignify an imperial capital, like marble, silks, gold, statues, and everything else.
Simon has spent his career building up a picture of how Portus worked. But after years of digging, it's still not making sense. He is hoping that Sarah's technology can help complete the puzzle.
What would you like Sarah to look for? What would it be great if she found?
What she really needs to focus on is canals, primarily, because what we don't know so much about is how all this worked. But I guess the really special thing to find, it would be too much to ask, but one just hopes that maybe by looking at satellite imagery, we can add more to, or perhaps even find, the great lighthouse of Portus.
Travelling over water at night.
The lighthouse of Portus is one of the lost wonders of the ancient world and was said to be visible from over 20 miles out to sea. Sought after by archaeologists for centuries, it's considered the ultimate symbol of Roman power. And finding hard physical evidence for its existence would be one of the greatest finds of Simon's career.
At dusk, a plane passes overhead above the base. Inside, Sarah's at her desk on her laptop.
Sarah, how's it going? Yeah. You've been here all night.
Burning the midnight oil.
Looking good?
Well, not quite. I mean, this is a really, really difficult landscape. You've got tons of urbanization, which you can see here. You know, I've been looking, you know, up here, and, you know, things that I think might possibly be ancient turn out to be modern the more I look at them. So it's pretty complicated, and I'm still trying to get my head around it.
Well, I don't really understand this. There's not much I can do to help. So I'm going to get some sleep. You keep at it.
Lucky you, Dan.
Dan leaves Sarah poring over her laptop, studying satellite imagery, first overlaid with a blue filter, then a yellowish green, as she works on tirelessly. Then, daytime, and the runway of Fiumicino Airport. Sarah, in a waterproof jacket with the hood up, walks across grass to a narrow road near the airport complex.
After working all night, Sarah has found nothing. And the reality of what she set out to do finally hits home.
We're in the middle of this blighted urban wasteland. I keep thinking, you know, how is it that the satellite imagery can possibly show us what might be here? There's really nothing here that's visible that hints of the glory of this once great port of Rome. Maybe I'm naive in thinking that it will work this time. Maybe I have bitten off more than I can chew.
We're not giving up on Portus, but with Sarah clearly struggling with her satellites, it's time for me to take temporary charge. To understand how Rome ruled its vast empire, there are several key areas to look at. But for me, as a military historian, there is only one place now to go.
A green, tree-covered mountain range.
Transylvania. Dark. Impenetrable. And in the 2nd century AD, a mountain kingdom ruled by a tribe the Romans dismissed as barbarians. We're leaving Portus for now and heading to Transylvania, part of modern-day Romania. Because what happened here is the best example I know of the Roman army at its most ruthless.
A drawing of an ancient battle.
From deep in the forest, a barbarian tribe called the Dacians were getting too big for their boots. Raiding Roman territory, stealing livestock and women, and giving the greatest empire on earth the proverbial two-finger salute. By themselves, the Dacian barbarians posed no real threat. But Rome had built its reputation on ruthlessness. Rome understood that if it showed any sign of weakness, similar rebellions could rise up right across the empire. The Dacians had to be made an example of.
A huge stone face.
Including their renegade leader. Now a martyr and symbol of rebellion. This is Decabalus, king of the Dacians.
From a boat, Dan and Sarah look up at the king carved into a rock face.
Rome had military commitments right across its vast empire, but it knew it had to prove a point. It threw an astonishing 60,000 men at the Dacians, and in doing so, sent out a clear message. Never mess with Rome.
The hull of a boat slicing through the water.
But to get at the Dacians, the Romans first had to cross one of the most formidable natural barriers in the entire world. Nearly a mile wide, fast flowing, with murderous currents, the mighty Danube River.
Sunlight shimmering on the vast expanse of water. Dan's on a motorboat travelling through it.
What's most remarkable is how they did it.
On a ship moored in the Danube, Dan's being zipped into a diving wetsuit.
It's going to be a very challenging dive today. The Danube is difficult the best of times. You can just see the way this current swirls around, racing down there towards the Black Sea. And the visibility looks particularly bad, so lots of things to worry about. So we've notified international shipping. It's time to go for it.
Okay, Johnny. You can just stand on one side. Are we ready to go on this, gentlemen?
Dan gives a thumbs up, then jumps into the murky, cloudy water. Strands of weed and other detritus float in the green and brown tinged water.
It's quite hard going, there's another current. Very, very slow.
Sarah's communicating with him on a walkie-talkie from the ship.
You might want to try going down to the base of the river just so you can crawl along over so I can give you directions.
Bubbles stream from Dan's mask as he breathes. He looks around.
Okay, I'm getting close to what looks like the bottom here. Wow, there's a lot of current down here. Making very slow progress.
It does look like the water's sort of whipping around you pretty quickly. Be careful down there, Dan.
Just dragging myself along the floor of this riverbed. There's a lot of current. It's what I'm looking for, shipping here somewhere close by.
Dan, why don't you try going about maybe 3 or 4 meters to your right? I think you're a bit off at the moment.
Standing upright, Dan disappears into a swirl of brown detritus.
Sarah, I can see something. It's very hard to tell through this incredibly bad visibility.
I'm beginning to make out the faint outline of something. Describe to me what you're seeing, Dan.
Through the gloom, what seems like a moss-covered wall.
Do you see it? I'm touching it now. It's clearly what appears to be the footings of a bridge. There's some brickwork. You can see the water. It's pretty overgrown now. But I think what we're seeing here is evidence for the Roman bridge across the Danube.
And not just any old bridge. It was the longest bridge in the entire world. Nearly a mile from bank to bank. One of the biggest works of military architecture in the history of the Roman Empire.
Dan climbs out of the water back onto the ship.
Well, that was just incredible. Definitely saw the footings of the Roman bridge. It's an incredible testament to the engineering prowess of the Roman army that, even after 2,000 years, one of the fastest, busiest rivers on the planet, still there.
Looking out across the placid waters of the Danube with the opposite bank far in the distance.
This really was a titanic undertaking. It took them around about 2 years, a long time. Actually, I think the Romans would potentially have seen that as an advantage. There's something crushingly inevitable about the slow progress of this bridge across this mighty river. You can just imagine the Dacians standing on the other side, seeing it edge closer week by week. And it was a message designed not just for the Dacians on the other side of the Danube, but for people all over the empire and beyond. This told people that no mountain was too high, no river was too wide. Rome would spend any amount of money and deploy any number of soldiers to enforce its domination. And by building the longest bridge on the planet, here on the Danube, Rome was laying claim to mastery of the known world.
Flying over a map to Eastern Europe.
Once across the river, it's believed that the main contingent of the Roman army, led by their all-conquering emperor Trajan, hacked and killed its way up the Giu Valley, heading north towards the barbarians' capital city, Sami Segusia. Or Sami for short.
Sarah, I'm dying here. This car is tiny. I'm getting cramped.
Dan, you gotta stop complaining. We got a long way to go.
That's tough love, man.
That's what you're getting from me.
King Decabalus and his warriors were finally defeated here at Sami. Archaeologists believe that after the war was over, the Romans suppressed outbreaks of sporadic violence with an occupying army. But how they achieved this isn't known. There could be clues buried beneath the undergrowth. But there's a problem. The whole area is completely carpeted in thick forest. And Sarah's satellites can't see through trees. Fortunately, all is not lost.
The doors of an aircraft hangar slide apart, revealing a twin-engine plane, which is towed out by hand.
This is new for Sarah. It's called LIDAR, a revolutionary technique used by the military to locate enemy targets in dense undergrowth. Here she's looking for walls, ditches, anything that might shed light on how Rome kept the peace once the war was over.
The plane takes off into a blue sky.
Rather than satellites, this involves an aeroplane, which fires up to 100,000 laser beams every second into the forest beneath. While the first beams hit the treetops, the last ones strike the forest floor. So by removing that first pulse survey, scientists effectively remove the trees, revealing anything which might be hidden beneath.
Emerging from a forest.
Okay, Dan, here you are. You're looking to the central part of the site of Sarmi Segetusa.
Dr. Gelu Floria is head of archaeology at Cluj University. He has spent 26 years investigating Sami and is the number one world expert on the site. Having surveyed the whole area, it's time for Sarah to show Gelu the results. And he's in for a big surprise.
Here we have a visual satellite image of Sarmi, as you know, far better than we do. The area is very densely covered in trees. And unfortunately right now, with satellite imagery, we can't see through trees. Mm-hmm. So we used a new technology called LIDAR, which is flown from an airplane and sends down thousands of pulses of beams of light. And you can literally use that to peel away the layers of vegetation. And this is what we have.
It's beautiful. It's amazing.
Let's zoom in a little bit.
What are we seeing there? Those lines are incredible.
It's a huge rampart-like feature that we never knew until now.
So you
know that shape and everything. It's beautiful. It's amazing, as a matter of fact.
It does seem pretty clear, kind of not as clear here, but kind of runs
No,
over.
It's absolutely clear on this side also, and here.
What Sarah has discovered is completely new to Jellu. According to conventional thinking, when Sami fell, the Romans left behind a garrison of around 500 men to hold the area and make it safe. But archaeologists have puzzled over how that could have been achieved with so few soldiers. It now looks like a massive man-made embankment enclosed the whole area, offering the mouth-watering possibility of fresh evidence into the extent of the Roman occupation. But we won't know the find is Roman until we see it on the ground.
Sarah, Dan and the team are on foot, making their way through a forest of thin, bare trees, walking in single file. A man at the rear of the group has a rifle over his shoulder.
We're setting off on a long trek through deep forest. It's rough country, and our guides, Mihai and John, are taking no chances.
Wooden shacks.
We're not going to make it before nightfall, and Transylvania is the last place you want to be walking about after dark.
What a nice campsite, eh?
Yeah.
Hello there.
Hello.
How you doing?
Hi there.
A crescent moon.
One more?
They're sitting round a campfire.
So, Mihai, you know, is there anything in kind of local folklore kind of connecting people here to the Romans?
Of course, we say that, you know, looking at the earlobe, the ones who have a long earlobe, you know, will be Romans, and the ones, you know, who have small one is Dacian.
Let's see what you got. Hey, Roman.
Roman.
Big emperor.
See, Ion? He has a long earlobe, you know, Roman.
What have I got?
You are certainly a Dacian.
I think I'm a Roman princess. That's for
See?
Sure.
You wish.
Yeah.
what do kids learn about the Romans in school? Are they invaders? Are they evil? Or are they the founders of Romania?
No, no. In history books, you know, all over, you know, Trajan and the Caballus, you know, the leaders of the two nations, they are fathers of our nation.
Oh.
So Trajan, most important, the Caballus.
Mihai, earlier today I saw that Jan was carrying a gun.
Why is he carrying it then?
For bears. Why else?
Sarah looks worried. A view of the team sitting around their campfire in the dark. Now, the sun streams through trees as they walk along.
The following day, the trek continues into the heart of an ancient forest. This is the original wild wood.
A grassy area.
Eventually, we find proof on the ground that Sarah's find is indeed Roman. This is the evidence we have been seeking.
I think this is the structure that we saw already on the photograph.
It's very clear. You can see it stretching off right the way down through. It looks like a ditch and then a bank here. What would this have been?
I think it's clearly an embankment, a rampart, and that's why I think it's part of a defensive structure, Roman temporary camp.
What phase of Roman occupation do you think this was built in?
Well, probably it belongs to the Roman garrison that was left here after the war. I can't think of another purpose than to pacify the area, to prevent any other skirmishes, to prevent any regrouping of forces around these sacred places of the Dacians and so on.
So this is they've won the war, now they're trying to win the peace.
Yes.
Watchtowers inside the garrison fence.
Sarah has finally found something, and it's helping to rewrite history. The 500-man Roman garrison was just part of a huge military camp. With enough space for a further 8,000 troops. It shows for the first time how Rome really pacified the area. Investing large amounts of troops and thinking long term. It wasn't enough to simply slaughter the Dacians and then leave. To remove the menace, whole swathes of land had to be first made safe and then incorporated into the empire. Imperial policy across the entire Roman world.
Dacia is just a terrifying example of just how the Roman Empire invaded and occupied new territory. When the Romans wanted to, they could bring vast and ruthless military force to bear. They invaded Dacia, they destroyed its armies, they wiped out its leadership, and then they set about the long and arduous task of pacification. They hunted down insurgents, guerrilla fighters. They destroyed religious sites like this, anything that could provide the focus for anti-Roman resistance. When you come here, you realize that for all the wonderful art and architecture that the Romans produced, at its root, Rome was a brutal military superpower. And that was a fundamental reason for its supremacy.
Sarah's at her laptop.
Sarah is starting to have success. But the good news doesn't end there. After months of searching, she thinks she's finally had a breakthrough with the satellites too. She thinks she's found something back in Italy that, if true, could be groundbreaking.
A computer simulation of the harbour of Portus.
Let's take another look at Portus, the great lost harbour of Rome. Understanding how it worked might give us a new insight into how the Roman Empire as a whole operated. This is what archaeologists think happened. Ships would crowd into the big basins. Their cargo unloaded onto smaller boats, which was then moved by canal to the river Tiber and onward along the river to Rome. But there's a big hole in this theory. With hundreds of ships on the water at any one time, there must have been major bottlenecks, crippling the whole transport network. It's something that has puzzled archaeologists for decades. Back in her lab in Italy, Sarah thinks she may have found the answer.
So I'd like to show you an interesting thing that showed up on the east bank of the Tiber. It's about 280 meters long, about 5 meters wide, running slightly southwest by northeast. You can see it running along just there.
Oh, now that's really interesting, because that looks to me like it might be a canal. Although I must say it's different to the other ones we found.
How is that different?
Well, all the other canals we found to date have been on the west side of the Tiber, close to the port, Portus. This canal is on the east side of the Tiber, and perhaps more significantly, it's going in the direction of Rome.
What does it mean that it's just heading off towards Rome?
For me, the significance is quite straightforward. The fact that you have a new canal here suggests to me that river barges may have avoided this rather longer route up the Tiber by going more directly to Rome. And indeed, that helps us better understand how the port system as a whole worked. So that's fantastic. Well done.
Walking through a field of tall grasses.
To test whether the new canal is actually there, buried beneath tons of earth, Simon and his team visit the site.
A large H-shaped scanner.
And the results of a geophysical survey are highly promising. It looks like Sarah is right.
For a really eminent archaeologist like Simon, who, you know, has devoted so much of his career to working at Portus, you know, seeing him get so excited about the science and be so willing to not only, you know, embrace it, but test it on the ground and think about the findings in terms of his long-term research plans for a site, that's awesome.
Now she's jogging through some trees.
it's great to have this confirmation. It's really exciting. But for me, what's even more exciting is it's really helping to show just how far the technology has come. I feel like that's given me a lot of confidence. I just absolutely cannot wait for what's next.
Sarah runs past a body of water, then a computer image of Portus.
Sarah's satellites are helping to show how this astonishing harbour landscape may actually have worked. An inadequate transport system could have left the people of Rome starving. Grain, in particular, had to be kept dry, so the faster it could be moved, the better. And this is how they might have achieved that. Boats didn't have to travel all the way up the Tiber River. They could go straight to Rome by Sarah's canal.
In a straight line.
It's also helping me answer the bigger question of how Rome kept control of its vast empire. We associate canals with the Industrial Revolution, but the Romans were building them 2,000 years ago, and not just in Italy, but in Britain and France. And like roads, they played a key role in Rome's success.
Portus is clearly an engineering marvel. I'm just blown away at the Romans' ability to build roads and infrastructure, to dig out harbours, just to get things done. And it's also taught me a huge amount about how the Romans controlled their empire. Because the Romans are famous for being soldiers, but clearly they're just as impressive as engineers. And by creating this infrastructure, by building ports, by establishing shipping lanes and building roads, they're shrinking their world. They're bringing their provinces closer to Rome and making it easier to control them.
Having finally got the satellites to deliver, it's game on. With such a vast area to control, Rome's military options were always going to be limited. A whole range of tactics were needed to stay in charge. But current thinking is incomplete. Sarah's challenge now is to fill in the gaps. Right across the empire.
Sunrise over a bleak desert landscape. Then, in bright sunlight, Dan and Sarah are riding camels across the sand.
Arabia. Exotic. Sophisticated. A land of adventure. And opportunity.
A dotted line on a map traces the route from Rome.
We've travelled over 1,000 miles across the Mediterranean to what was the easternmost fringe of the Roman Empire. Modern-day Jordan. Coming here is a chance to see something completely different to the killing fields of northern Europe. Amazingly, the Romans seem to have conquered this entire territory, then kept it under control, apparently without spilling a single drop of blood. Our mission is to find out how.
On a tablet computer.
All right, Dan, I want to show you something. Pinch in a little here. Can you see that there? See that?
Yeah, rectangular.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like a building.
And you think that might be Roman?
Hopefully it's Roman. That's what it looks like.
And it's never been discovered before?
As far as I know, it is a completely new structure.
Sarah, there is no end to your skills. That's very cool.
Pretty excited about it.
They ride on, passing through a fissure in the rock, which opens out to reveal a stunning building with a columned entrance, which seems carved into the rock face.
Sarah thinks she's made a brand new discovery, on the outskirts of an ancient city. but not just any old city. It is one of the most beautiful places on Earth. The rose-pink city of Petra.
They ride up to the towering facade, hewn into the mountainside.
I always wondered whether I'd come back here. It's a very special place for me, because I came here with my mum and dad when I was a kid, and our whole family walked through that narrow, dry riverbed, and we came out, I'll always remember it, we came out into that open space, and we saw the incredible building in front of us. I think that was really the moment that really fired my interest in history. Seeing these vast buildings hacked into the living rock, it's like nowhere else on Earth.
Dan stands and looks around at the remains of the buildings carved into the golden rocky ground.
But enough reminiscing. It's time to get back on the job and look at why Rome was interested in these lands in the first place. Before the Roman takeover, Petra was the capital city of the great kingdom of Nabatea, whose merchants had grown rich, controlling the important trade routes from the Red Sea to Syria. It was a massive money spinner, and Rome wanted a slice of the action in the form of taxes and tariffs. But whereas invasion would normally lead to resistance, here the opposite seems to have happened. And I think the reason may be partly cultural.
Bustling streets in a Middle Eastern city.
Unlike the so-called barbarians, the people here in the Middle East were literate and sophisticated. They lived in cities for a start. The sort of people the Romans felt they could negotiate with. To find out what the Romans had to trade, we're off to visit their fort at Azrak, which guarded the trade routes. Strong, impregnable, and built of solid stone.
Okay, you leave these doors to me, Sarah. Here we go.
Including the doors.
I can have a hand!
You need a Cambridge woman, Dan.
She helps him heave open the sturdy wooden doors.
That is ridiculous. Before the Romans arrived here, the Middle East had been the setting for conflict and instability since the very beginning of recorded time. This is where empires and civilizations clashed. You've got people like the Seleucids to the north, the Judeans and the Egyptians out there to the west, Mesopotamians to the east, and of course, the fierce desert tribesmen to the south. The result was constant violence. So when the Romans arrive, they bring peace and security. And it doesn't even take that big a military force to achieve it.
A freight train travelling across the desert.
This happened gradually, following the Roman takeover. But it looks like a guarantee of peace may have been enough to win the locals over without waging war. Because peace would bring prosperity. It's a theory that archaeologist Dr. Chris Tuttle believes. But despite being one of the world's leading lights on Roman Arabia, he has yet to find the proof. That's because, after 2,000 years, evidence of widespread abundance under Roman rule is almost impossible to come by. But with the aid of state-of-the-art satellite technology, all that could be about to change.
I've been surveying an area in the countryside around Petra, about 10 square kilometers, which you see right here, and there are about 60 features that have appeared, which show up in these red circles.
Okay, wow. This is really incredible. I mean, there's so much stuff out here that you're finding in this in these satellite images. Based on what I know of this area, this is probably farmsteads, hamlets, possibly some watchtowers. Maybe these are agricultural water management systems. All in all, really suggesting a landscape of abundance, not just inside Petra, but outside as well.
Now, what really interested me, Chris, was this particular feature right there. And let me zoom in a little bit more. You can see it pretty clearly here.
Wow, that's very large.
So this, out of all the features that appeared on the satellite imagery, really kind of grabbed me the most.
Well, we should go take a look at it. See if it has occupation during the Roman period.
I'd like to see it.
All right, let's go.
We're heading into a countryside that appears barren to look for evidence that it flourished under the Romans.
Their truck passes along a dusty track through the desert.
It's a confusing landscape of sand and rubble. But with the aid of satellite technology, Sarah can take us straight to the spot.
They draw to a halt on the rock-strewn plain.
Wow, you guys, this is a really big site. Very exciting.
So what do you think it might have been? Like a domestic or fort, something like that?
Well, actually, it's most likely related to farming, and it's very big, so we're dealing with something like it's a big farming system. This is probably the farm estate house.
What do you think the time period might be for this site?
Hard to tell without finding something to see if we can date it. Why don't we go take a look?
Let's go.
All right.
Okay, what are we looking for, archaeologists?
Pottery.
okay.
Sarah bends to pick something up.
Ever since I started hanging out with Sarah, I've had a crook in my neck, so she spends the whole time staring at the ground looking for smashed old bits of pottery, which she then claims, like this one here, which she claims she can tell the date from. But, I mean, you've got to be kidding me. I think that's all they do in archaeology school for 3 years, is just look at old bits of pottery. Now, historians, we like a bit of papyrus or a scroll. That tells you stuff.
Okay, let's take a look at what we found. Okay, a lot of stuff that we really can't tell much about. Those are really nice. I'm sorry. Sorry, Dan, no, but this one we can take a look at.
Good.
Sarah, these are perfect. Excellent, excellent. Well, we definitely have pottery here from indicating that this farm was in use during the Rome period. But looking at the size of it, we can see that there's even expansion that's probably taking place at this time.
From the work you're doing in Petra and from the results that are coming up on Sarah's satellites, this area seems to be flourishing.
I couldn't agree more. I think the satellite technology in particular is really going to help us get a better understanding of this time period here in Petra and in its surrounding environs. You've revealed a lot of potential sites that will help us understand this period in history a lot more.
In a computer simulation, the arid landscape becomes lush farmland.
Rome was mainly an agricultural society. The majority of its citizens were farmers. And we now know that thousands of them came from here, Arabia. Sarah's satellites show a countryside brimming with farmsteads, growing olives, cereals, and fruit trees. A flourishing Arabia under Roman rule. It helps us understand how Rome ruled without resorting to violence. Rome brought peace and prosperity, and a rich people are less likely to resist.
This leg of the journey has really helped me to get some answers to my original question. Just how did Rome manage to rule over such a vast empire, stretching here from the deserts of Arabia right the way across to the west coast of Britain, with actually a relatively small number of full-time professional legionary soldiers? I think coming here and seeing how it all worked has made me think about cooperation. I think the Nabataeans and the Romans that occupied Petra both realized pretty quickly they could achieve a lot more if they cooperated. Trade flourished because they could now export from here right across the empire and import goods as well. Also, the Nabataeans realized they didn't have to spend money on a standing army anymore because the Romans would look after external security. It was all very different in Northern Europe. There, the tribes that the Romans dismissed as barbarians were less interested in trade and interacting with the Roman Empire. They didn't want to go to the theater. They had to be destroyed one after the other with overwhelming military force.
Here in Petra, people saw the benefits of working with the Romans. I don't think the Romans needed to send armies through these streets keeping the Nabataeans loyal. The people here were happy to be Roman.
A computer-generated image of Portus.
It's time to return to Portus, the great lost harbour. Because creating prosperity, with or without warfare, would never be enough to rule an entire empire. There is more still to learn. The power of mind games.
At the base.
Back in her lab in Italy, Sarah has made an astonishing and completely unexpected discovery.
So, in this particular satellite image, you can see that we're to the northeast of the Trojanic Basin, and we're looking at fields, you know, partially cultivated. Nothing's apparent in them. So I looked at a satellite image from a different kind of year using assorted computer algorithms, and this is what I found.
Oh, good heavens. That's really interesting.
Simon, what is that?
It looks to me like an amphitheater. I mean, you can see by the oval shape and the fact that the sides are slightly squeezed that it's an amphitheatre-shaped building. No doubt about it at all.
So what would the significance be of a possible amphitheatre located here?
Well, if it was an amphitheatre, it would be, I think, very significant. I mean, one has to remember, first of all, that amphitheatres are amongst the most iconic of all Roman public buildings. They are very large, they're very prominent. They consist of banks of seating arranged around the edge of the building, focusing in upon an arena. And they were used for a range of activities. One has to think of public meetings or mock sea battles or animal baiting. But of course, the most iconic activity of all would have been gladiatorial combat. The potential of this for our understanding of the port is very significant. So, you know, well done, Sarah.
Amphitheatres were major status symbols, and Portus may have had one. There was only one way to tell for certain, and that's to dig. That could take months, even years. Even simple geophysics here is not straightforward, because this land is privately owned. But the satellite imagery is startlingly clear. And to find out what this might mean for Portus, there is only one place to visit. A larger version of Sarah's find. And the most magnificent building in the whole of Rome. The mighty Colosseum.
50,000 people would have packed into here. The mob. Tumultuous, riotous, capable of bringing down the government. Control this mob, the people of Rome, and you control the city. Control the city, and you control the Roman world.
For me, amphitheatres represent a coming together of perfect order on the one hand, and terrible violence on the other. A powerful combination which helped bind the empire together. Seating was strictly controlled. The rich and powerful sat at the front. Poor people and women at the back.
Dan gazes up at the arena.
It was a microcosm of Roman society, brought together to watch a spectacle of extreme brutality. To what end?
What was going on here in the arena of the Colosseum and in amphitheatres right across the empire was a giant communal celebration of conquest. Slaves were dragged in here from defeated enemy armies and from occupied provinces and then slaughtered again and again and again in huge reenactments of Roman victories. The people watching these spectacles would have been left in no doubt that Rome was utterly dominant.
A And nowhere was it more important to assert imperial authority than Portus, the gateway to the empire. It looks like, close to its heart, there was an amphitheater, the very embodiment of Roman pomp, swagger, and showmanship.
A computer simulation of the arena.
A building designed to send subliminal messages reverberating right across the empire. Back in Portus, it's an idea Simon Kay is keen to explore. For him, the whole harbour worked like some gigantic piece of theatre. The psychological impact of its buildings, every bit as powerful as their practical function. His team are busy excavating a part of the harbour, which makes the point perfectly.
So, sorry, what are we looking at here?
Well, we're right in the centre of the port, and in front of us, we have a building that's 200 metres long, 14 metres high, just dominating the basin as you approached it, and is the shipsheds of ancient Portus. These sheds would have housed warships belonging to a detachment of the Imperial fleet.
So we're talking here about an absolutely gigantic building. This is on a huge scale.
It is. It's on a massive scale. One has to imagine you're in a ship coming from the provinces and you've never seen buildings on this scale before. Pretty intimidating, I think. It's built partially functionally large, but also built to make you feel small. And that's exactly what this was intended to do.
So it's amazing because you've described this port as a social phenomenon, they're able to bring in all this grain, as an engineering marvel, but yeah. There's also a psychological dimension.
The genius of it is that it's about, as you say, it's about trade, it's about economics, but it's also about ideology and symbolism. It's very much a case of architecture being used as a way to try and control people. It's a very remarkable complex.
And there is nothing to make the first-time visitor feel more insignificant than a 25-foot giant dominating the centre of the port.
There's one last thing, and that is the long-lost statue of the Emperor Trajan.
It must have been extraordinary.
Trajan was the great general, of course. As you know, he conquered Dacia. He also undertook military campaigns in the Middle East. Its qualities are summed up in this great statue, which just dominates by virtue of its sheer scale.
What does that statue tell us about how he wants to be remembered?
Emperor worship was prevalent in the Roman world. It played a very important role in the political process. And I think to see a statue this size in the context of this great harbour, it would really have put you in your place and be a reminder about the strength of Roman power.
You felt like you're in the presence of a god.
Exactly.
They stand before a simulation of the towering statue of the Emperor Trajan, holding one arm up in a gesture of power and authority.
The giant statue and the shipsheds of ancient Portus were designed to dazzle the senses. Along with Sarah's fabulous new discovery, the amphitheatre. Only the great lost lighthouse itself was a more potent symbol of imperial power. And it was symbols, more than fighting, that bound the empire together.
Buildings like the Colosseum are so much more than just beautiful architecture. They are vital clues that tell us how Rome managed to maintain its grip on its empire. Nowadays, people get a lot of their information through reading newspapers and magazines or the internet. But back in Roman times, a lot of people couldn't read, and so symbols become vitally important. And that's why Rome builds huge statues, temples, triumphal arches, and amphitheatres right across its empire. Because they drive a simple message into the minds of anyone who sees them. That a civilization that's capable of building things like this is a force to be reckoned with.
We've seen the majesty of Roman rule around their capital city. Their crushing of the barbarian horde in Europe. And how they held on to power in the sophisticated East. Rome's vast, sprawling empire covered 5 million square miles of land. There is only one place left to look.
On a map, Africa. Dan and Sarah are travelling in a 4x4 along a road through the country. They're passing through a dramatic landscape of plains and mountains.
Africa. It's somewhere I've always wanted to come and see for myself. Because controlling these lands set Rome its greatest challenge of all. And it'll be Sarah's greatest challenge, working out how they achieved it. Crack this, and we'll complete the picture. We're flying to Tunis, in modern-day Tunisia, to begin our task.
An image of an ancient battle becomes stained in red.
After annihilating its bitter rival Carthage here in 146 BC, Rome seized a large section of the North African coastline. So far, so good. It met with little resistance. And Africa's rich, loamy soils could provide Rome with the one thing it craved more than anything.
Hey, Sarah, look what's in all these fields.
What's that, Dan?
You gotta take your head out of that computer from time to time. This is what it's all about. You see, it's pretty green because it's early in the year. We have been driving through miles and miles of wheat. Just look at that. So, I mean, this whole area is so fertile. And of course, we're only 2 days' journey by boat away from Portus, so this wheat can be in Roman bread ovens in just a matter of days. You know, even by 50 BC, this area is producing 250,000 tons a year. That's more than half of Rome's annual consumption of wheat coming from this area. I mean, this is Rome's granary.
But as Rome grew, so did its appetite. By the first century AD, it was the biggest city in the world, with up to 1 million inhabitants. And without enough bread to feed all those extra hungry mouths, there'd be rioting in the streets. With demand for wheat now exceeding production along the African coast, Rome turned its eye inland to the central Tunisian plateau. Ideal for wheat production on an industrial scale. But there was a problem.
A gas jet inside a hot air balloon, which lifts gracefully into a clear blue sky. Dan and Sarah stand in the basket below it, surveying the expansive view of the land below.
That's a heck of a view, Sarah.
It's just amazing just how much you can see.
Yeah.
It's vast.
It's a big, big space, this.
The plateau was nearly 17,000 square miles. So once the wheat was planted, how could Rome defend such a huge expanse of territory?
They're back in the 4x4, travelling across the plateau.
Nomadic farmers had been using this land themselves for generations as summer grazing grounds for their sheep and goats. Livestock which could eat or trample a farmer's crops before they could be harvested. So, to safeguard Rome's food supply, the pastoralists had to be stopped.
On a map, a line follows the coast inland.
To control their movement, and keep an eye out for raiding parties from the desert, a sophisticated frontier system was constructed. A series of walls and ditches stretching from modern-day Libya all the way to Morocco. But how could Rome, with such a small professional army, possibly defend a 1,500-mile-long frontier? The world expert on Rome's southern frontier is Professor David Mattingly. He thinks he knows the secret, but there is one gaping hole in his theory.
Hey, how are you?
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here in the desert.
Sarah is hoping she can help.
Perfect weather to find some Roman stuff.
Hello there. Sarah. Nice to meet you, David.
Lovely to see you.
All right, so, David, I wanted to show you something spotted from the satellite imagery. I wanted to get your opinion on what you think you're looking at.
What do you make of that?
Wow, that's wonderful. That looks like a Roman fort. That's a very distinctive shape.
Is it those round corners, the plain? Is that what makes you think it's a fort?
Yes, and it's got a large ditch around the outside. You can see some central structures within it. And then, I mean, this looks to me like quite a large settlement right around it.
Yeah,
almost like a village around it.
I mean, how exciting is this new technology? You're here on the ground. What does this add?
30 years ago, I came into this area with, before GPS, no satellite imagery, didn't even have air photographs. So I had some old maps and sort of 19th century references to the odd site. And whereas I found some elements, the garrison that manned the frontier was completely missing. And I've been waiting 30 years for the technological breakthroughs to be able to come back and complete the story.
But before we check it out on the ground, David wants to explain how the frontier system might have worked, with a relatively small number of soldiers acting more like border police than warriors. We're on our way to see something that doesn't appear in any tourist guide.
Follow me, but watch your footing on this.
Yeah, it's a good climb.
High in the Cherb Mountains of southern Tunisia, the Bir Ali Wall.
They climb to the summit of a rocky hilltop.
How amazing is this view?
Oh, it's incredible.
What a view. It's extraordinary.
This is a Roman frontier wall. It's running down the slope here, completely closing off this mountain pass. I like to think about this as a point of control in the landscape. Out there, desert landscape, little vegetation, we've got oases, there's some great salt flat areas, very desolate. Behind us, we've got rich pasture, agricultural zone. And what Rome is trying to do is to control the movement of people between the desert and that cultivated zone.
You know, the wall may have controlled them, but why not just keep them out altogether?
If they'd tried, they'd have been fighting a perpetual war with these desert peoples. This way, they incorporate them into the structure of the Roman Empire, and they can achieve that with a much greater economy of force. This becomes a permeable frontier rather than a line at which you repulse those desert peoples.
The idea that the frontier was policed by Roman soldiers acting more like customs officials than Royal Marines is an interesting theory. But it's only a theory. Where the soldiers came from to man this isolated outpost is a question David has never been able to answer.
But David, we should be getting pretty close. I can't see anything out there on the landscape. Can you make anything out, over?
Okay, I'm looking out. Can't see anything. It's amazing. Empty landscape we're looking at. Over.
Sarah, there's a fork in the road here. Do you want to go right or left?
We just continue on ahead according to my GPS.
Sarah, do you think it's the mound over there on the right now?
Here, shall we stop and have a look? Over.
Copy that. Over and out.
So how are we looking, Sarah? You think this is it?
Yeah, I think that's definitely it.
They get out of the two vehicles in a barren, empty plain.
Surrounding what may have been the fort is the 2,000-year-old debris of a large and densely populated village.
Look at all this pottery in front of us. Yeah, we need some diagnostic. Whoa!
So what can you tell from there?
Well, that's a classic early 2nd century Roman bowl, and that would normally, in this part of the world, at that date, go with a military site. So that's, I think, a pretty good confirmation that what we're dealing with on this side is military.
Wow. This is the ditch, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That's amazing. And this is the fort here. This is exactly like the satellite photo. It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, the platform of the fort just standing up here is really clear. Uh-oh, somebody's been digging.
This is not good.
Looks like we've had some local treasure hunters in action.
It's not good.
What, local people just looking for coins and things like that?
Just digging holes, isn't it? Yeah, I guess so, but look at this, it's even bigger.
We can actually see where the JCBs come in and dug out big chunks of dirt and deposited them on either side.
The only good thing about this from our point of view is we can actually see some of the archaeological levels that this is cut through, and there's about 2 meters of floor levels and deposits within this. Shows just how long this site was running for.
David, I can tell you're very keen to get your trowel out. You want to start digging straight away?
Well, it is very tempting.
So, what are we looking at here? What are these sort of this rocky area in the middle?
Well, from where I'm standing, that's just a chaos of collapsed boulders, really. I think, some help from space here.
All right, here we go. I'm here for.
This sort of stuff is so difficult to read on the ground sometimes, but the satellite images really come into their own.
There we go, so we're standing right about there.
You can see almost exactly where we are.
Okay, yeah, we can see the ditch and very, very clearly, but all that rubble in the middle actually represents what looks like a big square building.
What's it like for you guys, you're archaeologists? This is the first time this site has been visited by archaeologists. It was previously unknown Roman site.
Well, I came here all those years ago looking for exactly this sort of site. Couldn't find it, needle in a haystack in this valley at the time. But thanks to Sarah, here we are.
Well, I can tell you, David, that there's not just this one. There are actually up to 20 others just like it in this valley.
I'm going to have to take that away and look for some of that. That's amazing news. That it really is an extraordinary result. We're going to have to show me the rest of these in a little later.
We have a lot of articles to write.
What does this now tell us about this part of the Roman frontier that we perhaps didn't know before? What gaps does this fill in?
OK, let me do my sums quickly. In a fort like this, it's quite a small fort, so maybe there's 50, 100 soldiers here. But that settlement roundabout can certainly accommodate several hundred, maybe 1,000 people. And if you say there's 20 of these in the valley, we've got a very significant population in the valley here in the Roman period. And what that tells us is that the frontier worked.
Sarah's satellites are helping to show how the whole frontier system actually functioned. Troops were strategically positioned along the valley in a series of forts like this one, and used as border police to manage the movement of people across the frontier, rather than ban entry altogether and risk all-out war. And we now know that all of these forts were surrounded by large civilian settlements, which were prosperous and stable, proving once and for all that it was a system that worked. And worked well enough with a relatively small number of professional soldiers. It's a triumph, and one that calls for a celebration. And what could be more appropriate than an authentic Roman feast, cooked in the desert by a friendly expert, Sally Granger.
A few more quail for you.
Oh, wow.
Straight off the barbie.
Always room for another quail somewhere.
So how are you feeling about the high hopes we had for those satellite results? Have you seen it on the ground? Are you happy with what you've seen?
I'm absolutely thrilled. We think we've answered every question and found everything there is to be found, but what the satellites are showing us is just so much more left to find. And I think, it's the most exciting time in history to be an archaeologist.
And I'd drink to that. And I'd say thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you, David.
And Dan.
Thank
you. And thank you very much for taking us around. Thank you for the meal.
fading sunlight breaking through grey clouds, then the sun disappearing behind the horizon in a deep red sky.
This trip to Tunisia has taught me so much about Roman frontiers, both here in North Africa, but right across the empire. These aren't just physical barriers, they're psychological barriers. They dominate the landscape like no other empire has done before. And I think that everybody who crossed those walls, whether you go through one of the gates or even manage to sneak over at night, everybody who crossed those walls would know they were now in Roman territory. It's also been so interesting just how clever the Romans were as well. They didn't just try and seal off the border and block everybody out. They were happy to let traffic through as long as it suited them. They even encouraged it. People were allowed to come through the wall, trade was allowed to happen, but only if it suited Rome.
The harbour at Portus.
We're back in Portus for one final look. The great lost harbour is at last making sense. Sarah has discovered another canal, bringing new insight into how this fabulous port complex actually worked. She's even found an amphitheatre. But the greatest prize of all has eluded her.
Simon, there's something else I'd like to show you that I think you'll find of great interest. So here we have the Claudian Basin with the northern and southern quays. Based on this hypothetical location, I've done some preliminary imagery analysis work that I'd like to show you.
Okay.
Sarah takes a satellite image and zooms in on it, revealing a small bordered area.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's very clearly something there. I mean, I'm not entirely convinced what it is.
It's the culmination of Sarah's work and effort, the final piece of a dazzling great jigsaw. But maybe she's got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the results are at best ambiguous. I mean, there's a shape perhaps, but at the very least, it showed me that there could potentially be something there, and it was worthwhile doing additional processing work. So I used a different kind of image called LiDAR. Actually, it's the same thing we used in Romania. We used different types of processing. And this is what showed up.
Good heavens. Now, this is a different prospect altogether. This is really incredible. You can see very, very clearly how that massive feature is at an angle to the modern buildings there, and also it's centrally located between the north and the south quays. That's extraordinary. And the other thing is that it's immediately to the west of where my Italian colleagues have been working, doing deep coring and finding large chunks of masonry and some geophysics. Could I ask how big that is?
Right, it's about 140 meters long and about 40 meters wide.
Dare I say it, that this is the platform of the long-lost lighthouse of Portus. I can't see what else it can possibly be.
Simon, just how exciting is that?
I mean, it'd be pretty hard to overestimate the significance of finding this monument. I mean, people have been looking for it for hundreds of years. The lighthouse of Portus was one of the great monuments of the Roman world, commemorated on coins and inscriptions and images all over the empire. It really represents the ultimate symbol of Rome's political and military domination of the Mediterranean. And indeed, given where the Mediterranean is in the Roman Empire, the empire as a whole.
Imagine you're on a ship approaching the great harbour of Rome at night. The sky would have been dark in antiquity. And the first thing you would have seen is a light floating in the sky. It's like nothing you've ever seen before. An incomprehensible force, sucking everything in. The people. The grain. The slaves. Everything.
Travelling over water towards the dazzling light, which then engulfs everything.
To visit the probable location of the lighthouse involves a short trek across broken waste ground on the edge of Fiumicino Airport.
Are you okay there?
But there is one more surprise in store.
Okay, now it's just over here, just there.
Hang on a second. Are you telling me we've come on this entire journey to find the ultimate symbol of Rome and it's in a scrapyard?
Well, let's have a look. Now, Sarah.
Yeah.
The feature that you found,
right.
The platform of what we thought was the lighthouse, it was 140 metres long, 37 metres wide. So I calculate that the base of the lighthouse would have been 30 metres wide, which means that it would have stood 110 metres high and would have been right over there.
A simulation of the enormous, towering lighthouse rising up behind the cars in the scrapyard. Then, the massive three-tiered brick tower standing proudly. Daylight turns to darkness, and at the top of the lighthouse tower, a blazing fire. It stands forbidding and ominous against the dark, cloudy sky.
When we set out to use satellite technology to map the Roman Empire, I genuinely thought that it was a completely crazy thing to do.
The cultivated farmsteads in Arabia.
What I've come to realize is that my first real love has, and I think always will be, finding things. Part of me is relieved it's over, just because of all the challenges we've had and everything we've been through. But part of me kind of wonders what's next.
The lighthouse with its column of flames.
It's been a massive privilege watching Sarah work on this trip. I'm just so excited that it seems like she's discovered the site of Rome's lost lighthouse, the symbol of their domination. And I've learned a lot on this trip about what underpinned Rome's domination. Yes, Rome was a military power, but she realized that wars are expensive and they create a backlash. They almost inflame opposition. So Rome was also a psychological empire. Rome overawed people. Rome impressed people. Rome won respect by creating prosperity and security. So the situation is that people actually started wanting to be part of Rome's empire. They started collecting their own tax. They even started policing themselves. Now that's clever. And that's what underpins Rome's greatness.